Well, as we continue, the sixth, or the fifth vision here in chapter 5, and I'll need to really get to it because the last vision in chapter 6 is action-packed. But this one is so significant from the standpoint of looking at history, both in terms of what happened to Jewry and in terms of what's going on in our ecclesias today. So we have this vision of the flying scroll that was regarded as a curse, and it had two sides to it, lies and swearing, false doctrine that robs brethren of their salvation, and swearing in that those who adhere to the name of Christ under whatever banner it is and their lifestyle belies them. And we ended off here then with verse 4, I will bring it forth, saith the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter into the house of the thief and into the house of him that sweareth falsely by my name, and it shall remain in the midst of his house and shall consume it with its timbers and its stones. Now this was to go forth throughout the face of the whole earth. It started out as a Jewish Hebrew phenomena historically. It came to its conclusion in 70 AD, when then things morphed into a new stage, i.e. the second stage, the woman in the ephah. Now, reference here to consume it with its timbers and its stones. This takes us to Leviticus chapter 14. So if we'll turn that up, please, you'll be able to see what's going on here and how this phenomena developed to the demise of Israel at the time of Christ, when he arrived on the scene, took the lid off the ephah briefly, exposed its contents, put the lid back on, and away went Jewry into the land of Shinar. Now, this in Leviticus 14 is from verse 33 on, you might say, the cleansing of a leprous house. So, verse 35, and he who owneth the house shall come and tell the priest, saying, it seemeth to me there is, as it were, a plague in the house. So, you can put your mind around this, and you can call it mildew, you can call it mold, figuratively. It's a pocket of sin that dwells in this scriptural or spiritual house, and it's the house of Israel. As this thing spreads, everyone knows if you have a dose of mildew, you want to get right to it. So, verse 42, and they shall take other stones and put them in the place of those stones, and he shall take other mortar and shall plaster the house. Verse 44, and if the plague be spread in the house, it is a festering leprosy in the house, it is unclean. And he shall break down the house and its stones and its timber and all the mortar of the house. So there is left an opportunity for cleansing and reconciliation. The product of this scroll of sin that went forth, but alas, the house came infested. So that at 70 AD, and you see in Leviticus 14, it was the job of the priest who came, inspected the house, made the final decision what happened to it. Jesus did the same thing, did he not? So here we are, and I'll show you how that plays out. Let's go to Matthew 23. Matthew 23 is where Jesus comes on the scene now in due time. Behold, a body I have prepared for you. And so Jesus comes upon the scene where now the lies and the false swearing has wreaked its havoc with the priestly order in Israel. And now the priest, Christ, comes on the scene. He inspects the house of God. Recall, he said, you have made my father's house a den of thieves. Jesus was naming it for what it was. He identified the problem. Now, in his famous soliloquy here in Matthew 23, look what he says. But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, neither permit them that are entering to go in, because of the lies, the false, the swearing, the false doctrine, the result of the flying scroll centuries earlier, you know, the time of the giving of this vision to Zechariah at the end of the 500s, and now here it is, 30 AD, and look what's happened. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you compass sea and land to make one proselyte. When he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. A whole list of woes, looking into the leprous house of Israel at this time. Now, here verse 32 is a pivotal verse. Fill up then the measure of your fathers. The measure is this ephah we're going to consider in just a minute. The ephah was a measure of commerce about the size of a bushel. And we're told in Zechariah verse 6 from 5, and he said, what is it? And he said, this is an ephah that goeth forth. He said, moreover, this is their resemblance through all the earth. The word resemblance is rendered I, E-Y-E. This is the Hebrew I, then, at this time. They have become totally monetary, commercial. Their eye is on money. This is their resemblance. So, here is Jesus in 32, back in Matthew 23, verse 32. Fill up then the measure of your fathers. The ephah is now full. You serpents, you generations of vipers, how can you escape the damnation of hell? So then he goes on with his indictment, and then we go on over here, and he says in 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets, stonest them who are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings. And then he says in verse 38, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. It is now your house. Look back, if you will, in Matthew 21, verse 13. Matthew 21, verse 13. While there is still hope for repentance and reconciliation, he says, it is written, my house shall be called the house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. So we go from my house over here to where Jesus has divorced himself. And he calls it now your house. You see that in verse 38? Your house is left unto you desolate. So now the leper's house of Israel has been condemned. And the only thing left for it is for it to be destroyed. So now you flip over to the next chapter, 24 of Matthew, and you'll see how this all ties in. In verse 3, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age? So this is what Jesus then goes on to say. Behold this temple. I say unto you, not one stone shall be left intact upon another. And that's exactly what happened at 70 AD. 70 AD then was when the result of the curse that went flying forth throughout the rest of Jewish history brought down the house of Israel. And we know that it changed out that dispensation, the Mosaic order. And we know now that from the next portion of this, the ephah and the woman in the ephah represents another era or dispensation or the result of this curse, this scroll that went forth, and now it goes forth out of Israel into all the earth. And we're told at the end of that in verse 11 of Zechariah 5, and he said unto me, what's going to happen. To build for it a house in the land of Shinar, and it, and in the RSV that's better rendered her, which is appropriate for an ecclesial system, and a new ecclesial system shall be established and set upon her own base. So what happens? The Jewish scene then changes. Now, the two women who are referenced as storks, stork is an unclean animal, and it's the two women, the unclean sisters of Zion, i.e. Judah and Israel, who have been thoroughly corrupted now, like storks, catch the wind, which is representative of Yahweh's judgment, and this system now, a woman sitting comfortably in the ephah, or the measure of their economic symbol, where they are totally focused, is blown into another country, the land of Shinar. Shinar, you know, is rendered the enemy's tooth, and the enemy's tooth at that time was not only historical Babylon, where Jews did go and establish a little stronghold, in addition to Rome, which was the prevailing government at that time. Now, what did Jesus do in Matthew 23? He lifts up the lead cover to this ephah, figuratively. Lead is an unclean metal, is it not? It's toxic in its own right. It causes lead poisoning. It can kill you. It's nothing to be desired. It's easily melted down. The meltdown came at 70 AD. It was toxic to the nation of Israel. Jesus lifted, exposed the contents, a woman sitting comfortably in the basket, a Babylonish woman, the residual of the Babylonish captivities of both Assyria and Babylon. These influences had come back to Israel, even under Zerubbabel, and had permeated Israel historically and had wrought its work. Jesus exposed it, put the lid back down. The winds of judgment came along, 68 AD, 70 AD, 125 AD for the final coup de grace, and blew the Jewish religion, now totally a Judaizing religion, into a foreign country where a new religious base was to be established. Now, the new religious base. What was going on at that time? This is the true usage of the word Judaizers, by the way. This contemporary, present-day use of the word Judaizing is a misrepresentation of what historically was going on. And quite frankly, it tells you that those using the term today don't know their history. Judaizing was the apostate teaching of clinging tenaciously to the law of Moses, which precipitated the Jerusalem conference in Acts 15, which really didn't resolve anything. But it was all of this churning of Jewish converts to the truth. Here's a quote from Watchman What of the Night, by the authors Walker, Nichols, and Brother Willie, and they in turn were quoting Mosheim's Ecclesiastical History. It will easily be imagined that unity and peace could not reign long in the church, since it was composed of Jews and Gentiles who regarded each other with the bitterest aversion. Besides, as the converts to Christianity could not remove the prejudices which had been formed in their minds by education and confirmed by time, they brought with them into the bosom of the church more or less the errors of their former religions. Thus the seeds of discord and controversy were early sown and could not fail to spring up as soon into animosities and dissensions which accordingly broke out and divided the church. The first of these controversies, which was set on earth on foot in the church of Antioch, regarded the necessity of observing the law of Moses, and its issues is mentioned by Luke in Acts 15. This controversy was followed by many others, either with the Jews who violently attacked the worship, were violently attached to the worship of their ancestors, or with the proponents of a wild and fanatical sort of philosophy, or with the such as mistaking the true genus of the Christian religion, abused it monstrously to the encouragement of their vices and the indulgences of their appetites and passions after the flesh. So this then was what started to churn and permeate in the ecclesial system. And so here we have a quote on the overhead from Jeremiah 5:30. An appalling and horrible thing is committed in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means, and my people love to have it so, and what will you do in the end of it all? And we might ask that ourselves. And if we didn't have any hope and know that Christ was returning, we would say, what do we do in the end of it all? We see a deterioration in our Laodicean ecclesial systems. We know there is resolution at the end of the measuring line. There was resolution at that time at 70 AD as well. Now, we read also in Hosea 4, verse 13, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me. Thus God did cast aside Israel for their sins. So the wind that we're told that bound up and blew this system out of Israel, because now Israel was destroyed, this wind represents the prevailing judgments of God. And we all know the history of the, quote, wandering Jew, don't we? Blown throughout the underbelly of Europe, Asia Minor, they infiltrated and did their work in the seven lampstand ecclesias. And this then is what's represented here. The stork is an unclean bird building a house in the land of Shinar, the fourth beast, Rome, the land of the enemy's tooth. Now, out of this was to come a number of things. We can quote from H.P. Mansfield first. This vision traced the spiritual decline of Israel until a commercialized Judaism arose to supplant the true spirit of the law by a deadening formalism and to superimpose itself upon the truth in Christ, causing the great apostasy to arise in spiritual Babylon. Thus a new house, a new religious system was to come out of this turmoil. Now this is really amazing to reflect upon. The churning, the controversy, the influences of the Judaizers who would not buy into Christ, the Son of God, understanding the blood of the covenant, formed a seedbed that sprung forth and out of which came the apostasy, the apostasia, the falling away. The falling away from what? The falling away from the truth, correct? And this then is the spawning of the Catholic system in 312 at the time of Constantine. The overhead shows a pregnant woman of the time, a pregnant Babylonian woman, if you will. Human gestation being 280 days, beginning with the pregnancy at 33 AD when Peter established the Ecclesia of Christ, 280 years later brings us to 313 AD, the time of Constantine, when Christianity won out over the existing pagan system. This was the birth of the man-child in Revelation chapter 12. And this then was that new system that came out of the seedbed, that came out of the results of the flying curse, the Babylonian woman in the ephah, and now Jewry had become totally commercialized, and alas, that follows the Jews as a stigma today. Barney Murdo doesn't help the matter any, does he? The person recently imprisoned for his tremendous Ponzi scheme. This then is what this overhead teaches. The true bride of Christ, in contrast, is a chaste virgin. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2. And thus, that is the teaching there. So this is a pivotal vision for us to grasp and to understand. So we have time now to consider the last and seventh vision laid down for us in Zechariah chapter 6. I will read the first 8 verses. And I turned, and this means that Zechariah turned back around another 180 degrees so that he can now see over the angel's shoulder, let's say, the first vision. This is resolution to the peaceful first vision. And I turned and lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, there came 4 chariots out from between 2 mountains, and the mountains were mountains of brass. Before the first chariot were red horses, and before the second chariot black horses, and before the third chariot white horses, and before the fourth chariot dappled or bay horses. You want to read that dappled bay horses, not dappled and bay horses. Then I answered and said unto the angel who talked with me, what are these, my Lord? And the angel answered and said unto me, these are the 4 spirits of the heavens which go forth from standing before the Lord of all the earth. We know by now Yahweh doesn't have 4 separate Holy Spirits. These are 4 manifestations or divisions of the will of God going forth to accomplish his will in various and sundry campaigns. The black horses, which are there going forth into the north country, and the white go forth after them. So, remember in our previous overhead, the land of hostility was in the north country. So, in this place, 2 charioteers are designated to go north and take care of the region of the greatest hostilities. We have a dappled going forth into the south, and we have, and they went forth and sought to go that they might walk to and fro through the earth. And he said, go from here, walk to and fro through the earth. So they walked to and fro through the earth. Then cried he to me and spoke unto me, saying, behold, these that go toward the north country have quieted my spirit in the north country, i.e. the land of greatest military engagement and confrontation that will surround what we understand as Armageddon. Now, the majority of these horses, and especially in the first vision, they are red or sorrel in horse language. Bright red, of course, we might say likens itself to arterial blood, fresh bloodshed. Dappled would be more of a red roan, which would mean a bloodshed mixed with white. White in this case, I have a thought on, which I'll share in just a second. Now, it goes forth between 2 mountains of brass. brass, we know, in Daniel's image, represented the Grecian, eastern portion of the Grecian Empire after its breakup upon the death of Alexander the Great. So this places the greatest hostility in a northwest posture and in that area. But this doesn't relax for an instant what's going to happen in the north country. You want to lay this beside the March of the Rainbowed Angel in Revelation 10, and I'll just go there briefly, because this is another way of reinforcing the March of the Rainbowed Angel, which you hear brethren talking about, and you want to just have your mind around that concept as well as Zechariah 6. Verse 1, and I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as though it were the sun, and his feet like pillars of fire. This is a picture of conquest and aggression. It's Christ in motion from Revelation 1, who had feet of bronze. Feet, hooves, horn. This is a warlike posture. And he goes forth and he has a rainbow upon his head. The rainbow, you recall, in its color scheme, red, judgment, and we have different phases of judgment as we work into the core, which after there is peace, at the end of roughly 50 years of conflict, when Armageddon's over, when Zechariah's first vision is realized, the warriors standing amongst the myrtles, anticipating the Feast of Tabernacles, we are ready to enter into the kingdom, and it's going to be a time of blue or royalty will prevail. But right now in Zechariah 6, we are in the outer layer of the rainbow. These all figurative of the saints in action. So that's just a little snippet and a reference there. Now we can say we have reference in Zechariah to north and south as to where these horsemen go. And by now you know that the chariots are cherubim saints. Cherubim saints. And we have the black and the white one going north. Black is rendered typically of intense destruction. You might think of the pictures of 9/11 when the buildings had come down and the tremendous clouds of black smoke that billowed up. That's what I liken this to. That's what the impact of Christ and the saints and the March of the Rainbowed Angel will accomplish in the earth. It'll be a horrendous thing. White, the commentaries say white is a state of protracted leprosy or the settling of intense gloom after warfare. I like to think of it as the work of Napoleon, who has been typed as a type of Christ only in his warfare, not in his character or anything else. But you recall how devastating Napoleon's armies were in Europe, and he ushered in a scorched earth program. So he would come in and he would devastate an army. He would retreat. His men were allowed to plunder and worse, burn the crops, take everything they could, so that for the countryside and the populace in Europe, it was total devastation, and that made his imprint all the more harsh. This is what's implied by the blackness and, I think, the whiteness. Now, here's my thought on what the white horse might represent. It's Zechariah 14:12. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouths. So this leaves room for the miraculous and all-powerful judgment of Yahweh. In addition to any conventional warfare, it opens up the very probable use of tactical nuclear weaponry and or lasers. The whiteness could represent that kind of judgment. Anyway, this represents what went north. Now we have the king of the north and the king of the south brought into play here because of the direction these chariots go. This word, king of the north and king of the south, comes to us right out of Daniel 11, does it not? And that's a very intricate stretch in the chapter there, dealing with the two generals after Alexander the Great's empire fractured into four parts. And it talks about the king of the north, which at one time was the Ottoman Turk, and the king of the south, which at one time was Egypt, and so forth. Whoever occupies those positions historically is called king of the north and king of the south. So we come into the end time. And at the time of Zechariah, there were raging competitions for who would occupy that position, even at his time. Israel now was granted a little bye. They were rebuilding the temple, but north of them they had the Persians raging, and south of them they had the Egyptians raging. But more relevant is the end game. So we know what's shaping up as the king of the north. We've considered that great mountain and Daniel's fourth beast already, have we not? We know what Gog is all about from Ezekiel 38 and 39. So this is what I've tried to picture here, is the great looming Daniel's image will stand up, albeit feebly and for a short interim, in Ezekiel 38. The king of the south will be those who will now say, "Hast thou come to take a spoil?" Because the way our governments are going now, and the way the UN has been effectively neutered, that's about all that they'll be able to do, just like they're trying to deal with Iran, right? Do you have nuclear weapons? Well, let's talk about it. So, the king of the north, the king of the south, will be represented by the nations that are in that position. We like to feel that. This would be English-speaking nations. And what did 9/11 accomplish? You know, people are so quick to chastise Bush and for our war in Iraq, and certainly it's the most unpleasant war, and we've lost a number of men there, 5,000. But what did it do? It got the English-speaking countries in the region, didn't it? Got them there real fast. So now we have a U.S. contingency. We have our flotillas in the sea, which can easily, from the attack of the king of the north, Gog, and his host in Ezekiel 38, they can easily be pushed around to occupy a more southerly position. Now, Christ and the saints, of course, have a say in what happens here too, don't they? Because they, in the march of the rainbow angel, will come pouring out of Sinai following the resurrection and judgment. Sinai is going to become, I feel, a giant war room. It's going to become a Pentagon as far as Christ is concerned. There his battle plan will be mapped out. There the saints out of every dispensation will be brought up to speed. And there the strategy will be to come up from the south to displace the king of the south, to displace the English-speaking nations. Christ doesn't need the King of the South to help him one lick accomplish his purpose in the Holy Land, does he? In fact, they're going to be in the way, and they are either going to have to capitulate and stand down, or they're going to be ground up in this melee. So the King of the South would appear to be those who ask, "Hast thou come to take a spoil?" Because if you're not a direct enemy of Israel, by default, you are a friend of some kind, albeit a jaundiced friend, as the UN now looks at the nation of Israel, and as the US now looks at the nation of Israel, and as Britain looks at Israel. So this then is what and where these charioteers are going forth from. White going to the north, black following it. Whatever kinds of lingering destruction and means this suggests, total devastating destruction. Jerusalem is the pivotal center for north and south. We have the dappled going south, which is a mixture of white and red, a red sorrel, if you will. And we have red going back and forth to quiet Yahweh's spirit. So this means that go from here, walk to and fro through the earth. So they walked to and fro. This horse is mop up. It goes back and forth in the earth and it roots out pockets of aggression and hostility that haven't been terminated by these larger, more specific campaigns, it would appear. There won't be any bastion or place to hide, you see. The saints can say you can run, but you can't hide. So, what is the net result of this? This is to quiet my spirit after this campaign is all over. Now, here are some verses to just add some color to this. I'm reading from Psalms 99 now, verse 1 to 2. The Lord reigneth. Let the people tremble. He sitteth between the cherubim. Let the earth be moved. Psalm 68, verse 17. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. And you want to read that word angels, the Strong's word 8132 is better rendered, it's rendered to change or to alter. So that would better be rendered saints. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of changed ones, the saints, the Lord among them. And a cherubim, once more, you recall, means resemblance of the majesty. Now, there are then four chariots depicted here. This is the military organization of Israel, and it was the order in historical Israel, ordered out under the ensign of the lion, the man, the ox, and the eagle. These went forth. And this then pulls in all of the other vision that we've considered. The giant cherubim of Solomon, the two olive trees, and the golden pipes. This is all part of that. Part of this process is, if you go with me to Revelation 14, let's pick up some more details of this battle scene, because that's exactly what Zechariah 6 is. This is a battle scene. Now, when you look at Revelation 14, we have the reaping of the vine of the earth, verse 15. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time has come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. So this ought to take our thought back to Isaiah 63, where we're pouring in the contents, the clusters of the vine of the earth, which go into this great wine vat, which is, you recall historically, you would have an individual squeeze this wine vat, and it's not a very good picture when you think this represents nations, people, and tongues in the wine vat of God's vengeance. And so out of it will come justice, and out of it will come resolution. And this then is laying alongside this reaping of the vine of the earth in Revelation 14. Because we're told, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. It's time. It's long past due. And then you come down to 18, and another angel, you see all the angelic activity that's bringing this about to happen. If you can only see what's going on in the nations now and what it will take then to pull this all off. Who had power over fire and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters, representing various arenas of war and hostility, of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And this is going to be then, where is the verse I'm looking for? Judgment even goes up to the 20. Thank you. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, outside Rome, outside the lake of fire, or continental Europe. The vine of the earth, the Babylonish vine, in contrast to the good Israel vine in John 15, the war will be taken to every pocket, every cluster of hostility, so that every island of hostility will be resolved. And blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. So this reaping will take place then throughout the earth, even to the handlers of the horse bridles, which represents the string pullers, the strategist, those that have strategery. It's to those that are planning the assaults in the boardrooms of Europe, in the boardrooms of the U.S., that are manipulating things in the Middle East, and who, of course, are trying to bring about the demise of the nation of Israel. That's how pervasive these horsemen will be. And the red horse, appropriately for arterial blood, will be going back and forth throughout the earth, making sure that none escape this judgment. So, this represents another picture of the progression of things. We have the four carpenters here in the four corners of this overhead with various and sundry tools that are dismantling the kingdoms of men. They are, and we are told in Daniel 2 that together this will come down. This isn't a one at a time thing. The stone power strikes the image on the feet, does it not? That's where it's most fragile. Clay and iron on the feet. Together the kingdoms of men come down in a heap, and they will all be destroyed at the hands of the four artisans who, you recall, were said to terrorize this system. This is the fourth beast. Mystery Babylon the Great. Isn't that a vicious looking system? A woman upon a scarlet colored beast. This is the end time. This is the very end time for the manifestation of the harlot, who is now atop the beast, now riding the beast, scarlet colored, full of sins. I sit a queen. I will never be desolate again, she says in Revelation. 10 horns are 10 kings who give their power to the beast. 10 represents a number of secular completion, does it not? We don't care if there are 15 or 20 or so members of the common market right now, or the EU. We know that when the time of Christ comes and all of this blows up, how many number are numbered under the EU will be the antitypical 10 kings who give and throw in their hat and their military might and their money into this system which will oppose Christ. So this is a coin. The one on the right is a modern Greek coin. She's a member of the EU now, and you'll notice that she is right in line. She has Europa riding the beast, and here is an ancient coin which depicts the same phenomenon. So this is what you have in history. This is what is brazenly put on a euro coin today. There is no misunderstanding the phenomenon. This overhead, Revelation 17:13, these have one mind, will give their power and strength unto the beast. So here we have the EU, we have the great looming Caesar, and over here we have a pope. So we have Rome in different phases, don't we? We have the land of Shinar, we have the new base religion, and collectively we have the ecclesiastical, and we have the secular, which will rival Joshua and Zerubbabel as in the time of the giving of these visions, and along comes Christ in the near future, who unites both kingly and priestly roles, so that Christ, the king priest, will destroy Rome and the apostate church. We now go back to our picture of the great mountain, which includes all of these contents. Just like you slice through any mountain, you're going to come up with all kinds of geological finds, all kinds of minerals and so forth. This is a slice through once more the looming great mountain that was before Zerubbabel. Now it becomes like the chaff of the summer threshing floor. And we were told in Revelation 16:20, and the mountains were not to be found. This is going to be a time of tremendous slaughter. We're told that the dead shall encompass one end of the earth to the other. This overhead shows war fatalities over the years. And Civil War, 140,000. World War I, 15 million. World War II, 55 million. That includes Jews there's the Holocaust, about 6 million. Vietnam, 55,000. Iraq, so far, we've lost about 5,000. You recall the battles with Joshua, the enemies would lose 20,000-30,000 in a given day. This is going to be a horrendous skirmish as Zechariah 6 plays out. Here's a timeline that's very familiar. Various brethren use this in their presentations. I don't know if I can get my mind around 10 years allotted to the resurrection and judgment. Maybe someone can explain that to me better. But this shows what has to take place within a 50 jubilee period upon the return of Christ. Elijah has to do his mission and bring back and teach and edify as many of natural Israel as he can, both in Israel and without. The Arabs have their day of judgment. Judah is saved and Gog is destroyed. We have the mid-heaven prophecy that goes forth from Revelation 14 to fear God and keep his commandments once Zion is secure. And of course, we know that the rest of the world will spurn that and everybody will be screaming Antichrist. During and toward the end of this time frame, the great Ezekiel's temple will be erected when the area is secure, and it'll be ready then for the Feast of Tabernacles at the end of this time frame. So here we are. We've come full circle. We're back to the first vision. War is over. The horsemen have done their job. They're standing down amongst the myrtle trees. Trees, we said, that are supple, fragrant, little white flowers. It's all over. The dust settles. This is the result of it all. This is the purpose. John 14, verse 27. Jesus said, "Peace I leave with you, my peace. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you." This peace that results from these battle campaigns and from the beautiful visions of the lampstand results only when it's a divine, worked out, and righteous peace and settlement. Is that not true? Peace today is just a cessation of hostilities. Let's negotiate our differences and we'll go our own way. This is peace for the earth. This is a cleansing of the earth. And this is a building of a new world order. Peace is rendered to set at once again. Nothing less than covenant peace worked out over the millennium and the eighth day. Religion means to realign, does it not? To realign. Thank you.